and let's see what happens. And Venerable, if you want to join in at any point, please just join the fray and add your comments. Okay, so first question is, can Ajahn please explain further the three common words in Manusutras, gratification, danger and escape? This is the Asada, Adinava and Nisarana. These are three words in Pali. And the second question is, what is the difference between causality and conditionality? Okay. So the three words that you are referring to, quite rightly, they are very common in the suttas, and it is a general kind of contemplation of these three characteristics. These are the characteristics of our experience. We experience things as it has a gratification. In other words, it has an upside, something that pleases us about things. And then things have a downside. This is the adinava, or the danger. And then when you weigh up the danger and the kind of the good and the bad, then you decide whether it's worth escaping or not, whether it kind of is a problem. So you do that with anything in life, anything within on the path, sensual pleasures. You do that with the five khandhas, you do it with the six sense bases, and you so you understand what the pleasure is in things. So for example, with the sense pleasures, you understand the kind of the happiness that comes from that, having a nice car, a nice house, all of these things. Sense pleasures always bring a degree of enjoyment. This is kind of why we like them. Otherwise we wouldn't like them if they didn't bring any kind of happiness at all. So you understand the happiness and the amount of happiness they can bring. Then you understand the danger, that they are impermanent, that once you're attached to them, they're going to be, it's going to become painful, and that sense pleasures always end in pain. They may be happy for a while, but the end point is always problematic. When you eventually pass away, everything has to go. So you understand the happiness, the good part, you understand the danger, the problem, and then you understand that when you weigh the two up, the problem is enormously much more greater than the benefit. Because it kind of carries on forever pretty much. And then you look for the escape, because you understand that there is a problem with these things. So that is the asada, adinava and nisarana, benefit and danger and escape. Interesting, in the suttas, the Buddha always says that he understands all of those three, and that is part of what it means to be awakened, basically, that having that balanced understanding of these things. The second question is about conditionality and causality, and the difference between them as they are used in English and as they are used in kind of Buddhist circles. In Buddhist circles, they are used almost often as synonymous. There isn't that much difference in them. But the difference usually would be that if something is a causal process, if one thing causes something else, it means that it is a necessary condition. Condition that has to be there, necessary and sufficient. It gives rise to the next one. It is a cause. Once it is in place, the next thing has to happen as a consequence. But conditionality is often a bit more not as strong. A condition can be in something that influences something else, but it may not actually cause it. There may be many things that are required for something to happen, it may not be a cause. So for example, if you are going to light a fire, you need a number of things. You need a fuel and you need a flame. You have to have both of those for the fire to light. So the fuel is a condition, it is a requirement, but it may not be enough for there to be a flame. It may not be a cause. The cause could perhaps said to be a spark, which ignites the whole thing. That could be said to be a cause, because once you have the fuel, then you get the cause, the spark, then you have to have a fire as a consequence. So there is a little bit of a difference there, but in Buddhism we often kind of treat these things almost as if they are synonymous. But causality is in many ways the more interesting one, like independent origination, for example. If you say that avijja paccaya sankara, the word paccaya there means causality, not just conditionality, but causality. Once you have avijja, you have to have sankaras. Once you have delusion, you have to have these volitions and the will that creates kamma. Yeah? These things are necessary. One thing implies the other one. Once you have a sankara, you have to have jnana. Yeah, so because of all of these links in dependent origination, one causes the next one. There's only one way to get out of it, and that is to undermine the avijja at the beginning and make the avijja into vijja. Once you have the insight, then the whole thing also comes apart. Yeah. So causality and conditionality here. Causality is the more interesting one for that reason here. Does that make sense? Yeah. People happy with that? Unhappy with that? Yeah. Neutral? Yeah. Causality is more important in a sense. Yeah. Yeah. More fundamental. Yeah.
Condition is, it comes after cause.
Comes after cause? It comes. Condition is a thing which influences something else. Yeah. So condition is something that may have influence, but may not actually be a causal factor. It may be, for example, it may be. How can we take if you eat something, yeah, the salt, if you add a bit of salt to the food, it's going to be conditioned for the taste, but it's not going to cause the taste. It will have a taste even without salt. So maybe something that has an influence on something, it may change the feeling. For example, sankara may be, let's say, what is a good question? Passa is the cause for vedana. But you don't know what vedana is going to come out of that passa, depending on many different causes. The vedana will vary depending on the kind of passa you have. So there is other conditions coming together. It's not just passa, there's the kind of passa you have and other factors that determine the vedana you have as a consequence. So conditions, they have an influence, but they may not be the thing that actually make it happen.
Right.
Something like that?
Yeah.
Do you think that, I just wanted to ask you, before I was talking about the Mahapanibbana Sutta and Mara talking to the Buddha and all these kind of things. What do you think about these kind of ideas in more traditional Buddhist context like Thailand? Are people going to think that I'm a really bad monk for saying this kind of things? Or do people have these kind of ideas in Thailand as well here? What do you think? You don't have to answer if you don't want to answer.
I don't know. It depends on depends on the teacher.
So if
teacher will have probably different look at different aspect of.
Yeah.
But I'm not into this kind of
thing. Okay.
Story. Mara.
Okay.
And stuff. Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know.
Okay, good. Yeah, so Venerable Kukri, he might agree with me. Is that what you reckon? Because he's more kind of. Is that what he meant? For example, as an example.
Who?
Venerable Kukri.
Kukri?
Yeah.
No, this is not the Buddha's word.
Yeah.
So he have no opinions about other stuff.
Okay, yeah.
Only the Buddha's word.
He might consider this the Buddha's word, because in that sutta it says that the Buddha said this, so he might see it as the Buddha's word. I don't know what he would have. Anyway, never mind. Let's leave it at that. Okay, let's go on to the next one. Dear Ajahn, is there any parallel in the Chinese Agama that suggests that the Buddha has told the Venerable Ananda three times that he can live on for the eon? The Venerable Ananda couldn't get this message, Sadhu times three. I I cannot remember all the parallels to all the suttas and all these things. I think it may be in there. I don't actually know all the parallels as well. There are about, I think, 3 parallels in the Chinese Agamas to the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. So remember, the Chinese Agamas are quite different from the Pali Nikayas, because the Pali Nikayas are from one school of Buddhism, whereas the Chinese Agamas are a compilation of suttas from various kind of schools. It's a very different kind of literature. So there you have 3 versions of the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, probably coming from different schools, and all kind of things. And that is kind of makes them very interesting, but it also is a lot of work to translate all of that. And because I cannot read Chinese characters, I would have loved to read Chinese characters, but I can't. I rely on translations. And I think the one translation that is available into English from the Chinese, I think it has a similar kind of thing there as the Pali has. Sometimes, even though all the various parallels have the same thing here, still it is not necessarily the case that it is original. It is more likely, but it doesn't mean that it is absolutely original just because all the various versions have the same thing. Because the versions, the various schools, they only started to separate around the time of Ashoka. Ashoka came around about 150 years after the Buddha. That's when the schools started to separate. But there may have been changes before that, and those changes that happened before that, they will very likely be part of all the various schools. So the idea of whether it is there in the parallel versions is only one criteria by which we can decide whether something is early or not. But it's not the only criteria. Another one would be what you call internal consistency. And this, in this case, I would say it is not internally consistent, because on the one hand, the Buddha is almost about to pass away because he's old, out of old age. On the other hand, you have this other story, so it makes you wonder which one is true. And to me, always the natural principles have to have precedence before the supernatural principles. So if there is a natural principle that already explains it sufficiently, there's no need to invoke this kind of supernatural ideas. So I tend to fall, because I say that because there is a clear tendency in the various Buddha schools to add supernatural principles, especially after the time of the Buddha. You can see that the later the literature is, the more supernatural principles you have. You go to the Mahayana literature and you read some of the suttas there, like the Prajna Paramita Sutta, which is a very fundamental sutta in the Mahayana literature. It starts off with 10 pages on all kind of miraculous and marvelous things. You can feel it has a kind of later flavor to it. The later you go, the more flowery and kind of marvelous and wonderful everything is. And this is one of those tendencies you see. So I'm not saying this without reason, but there are various reasons that you can use to make decisions on these things. But again, there is a degree of uncertainty there. This is just the way it seems to me. And of course, there isn't any absolute way of knowing, but that's my kind of feeling about that. If you're not happy with my answer, or you want to come back with an answer, a second question, you are very welcome to do so. You don't have to accept my answer as final or anything like that. You're very welcome to question further. Okay, if I'm wrong, it's really good, because if I'm wrong, then I have learned something. If I sit here and nobody challenges me, I feel like I'm always right. After a while, I might get conceited. I'm always right. So please challenge me if you want to. Okay. Next one. Oh, this is a two-page question. Okay. Dear Ajahn, reference to recollection of the Tathagata. A few years ago, I had a major surgery and was given morphine as pain management. After 2 shots of self-administering morphine, I felt very nauseated. Thereafter, I stopped the morphine and I chanted Itipiso until I fell asleep. I didn't suffer uncontrollable pain when I was chanting, and I didn't need the morphine at all. The pain management team was shocked that I only used 2 shots of morphine after the surgery. I'm not sure if my mind went into some sort of samadhi or if I was the power of the Buddha, but I definitely went to the Buddha for refuge and completely surrendered. Perhaps Ajahn has some advice. Thank you. That's a nice, very nice story. And it's, you know, a wonderful thing to be able to do. You don't have to use morphine, you just use the Itipisocha. That's really, that's very nice. It's very hard to say what is happening there, but, you know, sometimes if you have faith in something, sometimes the faith in itself can also be very powerful. And sometimes you have like the placebo effect. It's a very well-known fact in modern medicine. And sometimes this effect can be small, it can be large, depending on the situation. But the placebo effect is basically the idea that if you are given, you know, you have two pills. One is a real medicine, one is just a sugar pill. But even if you get the sugar pill, it's better than nothing. Yeah, you eat a sugar pill and you feel better as a consequence. That is called the placebo effect, because you get something and that kind of alleviates the symptoms. And even if you know it is a placebo, you know it is just a sugar pill, still it works. Yeah, this is kind of the strange thing about this. So the Itipiso, at the very least, it would have often a placebo effect. You feel good, you know this is a teaching of the Buddha, you feel kind of, you know, you're getting some kind of support simply by having that refuge, simply by knowing that there is something in your life that supports you, is often enough to give you a mental boost. So this is kind of accepted by modern medicine. There's no need to kind of ask for supernatural powers. On top of that, it may be that at this time you knew that you needed some support, so maybe you focused particularly strongly on this, and you, as you say, you used it as a refuge, so maybe you were able to focus so much that actually the pain kind of disappeared. I don't really know. I mean, it's hard for me to say based on the information you give, but something like that may very well have happened. Either one of those explanations. Is there anything beyond that? I don't know. Maybe not. I'm not sure. I think that is probably enough, really, to explain it. I don't think, was it the power of the Buddha? Well, it's just the power of the chanting, the power of the Dhamma, I would say, if anything. I mean, the Buddha is dead, so he can't really do very much, but it could be like the residue, perhaps, the remainder of that, in the sense of the Dhamma still being around, and then taking, as you say, refuge in that. So it's a very nice story. So thank you for sharing that. And these are the sort of things that you sometimes you can do. You can kind of get out of these things. I remember Ajahn Brahm also tells the story when he had a toothache. He had a very, very bad toothache many years ago. You may have heard that story. And he was also trying to chant. It didn't work for him. He was chanting away. He was almost standing on his head trying to chant, and it still didn't have any effect. And then eventually he just decided, okay, well, I can't, there's nothing I can do, I just have to let go. So he just sat down, and he decided not to have any desire anymore for the pain to stop. And then as he let go of desire completely, bang, it just disappeared. So again, it shows you that a lot of the problem with pain is in the mind. It's created by the mind. Let go of the mental part, and just, as you say here, surrender completely, and maybe that's what you did. Then the pain can disappear as a consequence.
The resistance,
yeah,
will cause the pain.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. It's like the two darts, yeah, in the sort of the two darts. So the pain dart and then the mental dart, and the resistance is like the mental dart. So you let go of that, and you have sometimes you realize that the physical dart was actually very small to begin with. It wasn't a big problem. The biggest problem was the mind, indeed. Okay. Dear Ajahn, in Sanyutta Nikaya 46.3, Ethics Sutta, page 116, paragraphs 2, 3, and 8, starts with, at such a time, a mendicant has activated the awakening power of mindfulness, etc. What is meant by at such a time? And it means like at any time, when you do this, that's what it means, yeah? At such a time, when a mendicant, maybe something is missing there. Just referring to it, whenever you do this, this is what happens. And usually the awakening power of mindfulness or awakening factor of mindfulness is, it's hard to, Is it during meditation or outside of meditation? It's difficult to do it outside of meditation because at this point your mindfulness is becoming very strong when it becomes an awakening factor of mindfulness, yeah? And it's not really, it's very difficult to uphold that kind of mindfulness outside of meditation. It's the sort of thing that happens when you sit down, you're watching your breath continuously and it's not really skipping too much, yeah? That is really the sort of mindfulness that is meant here. And this is quite a developed kind of mindfulness. Very hard to keep up that kind of mindfulness outside of meditation. The kind of mindfulness you want outside of meditation is sufficient mindfulness to be aware of what is going on in your mind. If you can have enough mindfulness for that, because then you can start to regulate your behavior. You can see that ill will is about to arise or desire is about to arise, too much desire, whatever it is, and then you can move in a different direction. You can change your perception, yeah, and these sort of things. And that is the kind of mindfulness you want in ordinary life, just sufficient to know what is going on. And that is quite hard already. Sometimes, yeah, to always, you know, catch your mind sufficiently to be able to catch the anger is about to, or upset is about to arise. Okay, stop, don't want to go there. And then you refocus in a different way. Huh? But if you can do that, wow, and already you have, that's already really good. And that, because then you have the possibility of managing your mind and having this thing that we call sense restraint as a consequence. Otherwise, you are at the mercy of the world around you, which is not so nice or useful. Okay. Dear Arjan, in what way is the sense restraint mentioned in the Kundalya Sutta different from the Bahya's teaching? In the seen, there is only the seen, etc. The Bahya's teaching is much more profound. The Bahya's teaching is the idea that when you see something, there is no self-reference, there is no identity, there is nothing, you don't make anything out of it. You don't have any papancha, that is what is meant here. Papancha is the idea when you proliferate. And this kind of proliferation can often be very, very subtle, that you refer to it somehow, refer to it to you, yeah, this is my vision, or you perceive it as being yours, or something like that. It can be very, very subtle. It can have to do with views, it can have to do with the conceit, I am, or whatever. So it's more primary. The defilement that we're talking about here in the Kundalya Sutta is more developed, yeah? First of all, you think that you might get hold of this, it might be yours, you relate to it somehow, and then the desire becomes quite strong, yeah? So one is a much more subtle thing than the other one, yeah? And the one in the Bahya Sutta is really a sort of thing that comes from very profound insight into seeing non-self of things, whereas the other one is a much more preliminary practice of calming down the defilements to a certain extent, and then from that, then you can have the kind of insight that they talk about in the Bahya Sutta. One is more preliminary, one is more profound. One has to do with the very idea I am, the conceit I am, the other one has more to do with managing your emotions in daily life. But you're right, they are related to each other, especially because when you take away the whole conceit I am, of course you're also dealing with the senses as well. I was under impression that Bahya's teaching is not something easily doable. Exactly, that's exactly right. Not at all. According to an article from Ajahn Brahm, one must have access to jhana to practice Bahya's teachings. Absolutely, because it is about seeing non-self and all of that. So you really need to have the jhanas to do that. So I think that is exactly right, what you're saying there. And so these things are not the same. And there is some uncertainty anyway. The Bahya's teaching is found in the Udana. There's also a similar sutta found somewhere in the Samyutta Nikaya, I think. And the Udana, if you do a comparative study of the Udana, there is a Chinese version of the Udana, there is a Pali version, and they are quite different. One of the differences is that the verses, the Udana is made of a verse, and then there is like a prose section before the verse. And the verses are often quite similar, but the prose section in front is very different in the Udana. So the verse section seems to be more original, whereas the prose may in many cases be stories that have been added later. which is a bit of a shame because the stories are really nice. Some of the stories are really kind of interesting sort of stories. Sometimes the best things are not original. Many people want to read all the stories in the Jatakas and the Dhammapada Atika. Some of the stories are really nice. And then someone tells you it didn't come from the Buddha, and then you feel really let down afterwards. It's very, very common. I mean, especially if you grow up in a Buddhist country like Thailand or Sri Lanka, you're grown up in a Buddhist culture. And many of the things that you learn in the Buddhist culture has got nothing to do with the Buddhist teachings. You learn all this other stuff. All the kind of things that have nothing to do. You learn the Santara Jataka and all of these kind of things. Very nice stories, but nothing to do with Buddhism. More to do with Brahmanism and that sort of thing that has to do with Buddhism. And then they come and say, but the Buddha said, no, actually he didn't say that at all. This is just, I was taught this because I grew up in a Buddhist country. Well, you don't really learn Dhamma very often when you grow up in a Buddhist country. What you learn is, it's strange, isn't it? What you learn is what the Buddhist culture has kind of brought to the front over many, many centuries and millennia, and these have become kind of what Buddhism has become. But that doesn't mean that necessarily you know all that much about the early Buddhist teachings. This is kind of interesting, and this is such a common thing across the Buddhist world and everywhere, that people have more knowledge and understanding about later Buddhism than the early Buddhist teachings. Anyway. So, let's go on to the next one. Dear Ajahn, I know anger is a defilement, and how it strains relationships at a time can be unkind. How do I gradually train myself to have a better temper and not to outburst my negative emotions? Okay, thank you. So this is what we talked about during the retreat time. I was talking about that sutta. It's actually in the book. So if you have the book, look at the sutta that is called the removing of resentment or something like that. Sutta. And that is a very nice sutta that shows you a lot about how to avoid anger. I will give you a couple of quick ideas which are straight from the sutta, just maybe to help you understand the sutta a little bit better. One of the main ways of getting removing anger is to remember the good qualities in people around you. And very often you find that temper may very often is related to certain people. There are certain people that trigger your temper more than others. It's always a bit like that. There are certain people we find more difficult. So start with those people you find difficult. And then, especially if they are part of the BGF, or they are a good Buddhist or whatever, it's quite easy to see the good qualities in those people. They come here, they want to be kind, they want to do the right thing. And straight away, if somebody wants to do the right thing already, they are worthy of a lot of praise. What a wonderful thing that is. So you build that up in your mind, you remind yourself of that. And the more you build that up, the next time they do something which irritates you, you remember that actually they have so many good qualities, and then your temper dies down, bang, very fast again. The quicker you remember that, the quicker your temper dies down as a consequence. This is one way, remembering the good qualities in people around you, building that up. And the other one, if there is someone you cannot see many good qualities in, then you have to have compassion instead. So you remember that someone who has all bad qualities, you remember that they are their own worst enemy. If you have really lots of bad qualities, you are a terrible enemy to yourself, because you're creating so much bad karma, because you're creating so much disharmony in your life, so many problems in your life. And then instead of getting upset with them, you can have compassion with them, because they are the ones who suffer much more than you do because of their own stupidity. They are blind, they are deluded, they don't know what they are doing. So when you look at them, you don't think about your pain or your problem anymore with them. You look at them and you start to feel a bit sorry for them. Gee, you don't know what you're doing. You're blind. You have all this, doing all these crazy things, and you are going to hurt the most. And then you have a sense of compassion instead. So those two together covers all people. Either the person has some good qualities and you can look at those and neutralize the anger through that. If they haven't got any good qualities, then you look at the side of compassion there. So we have a look at that sutta. That sutta has some beautiful similes to help that idea, kind of strengthen that idea. And then you have a very good foundation for overcoming ill will and anger here. It's not that hard to overcome ill will, at least to some extent. This is one of the really great ways of doing that. Remember that people have no self. From Buddhist point of view, they have nothing inside of them that is a rudder that is always driving them in the right direction, because they don't have that self, because they're always conditioned, and they are the sum of all the things that work on them. Because of that, you cannot really blame people for doing stupid things. People do something stupid. What do you expect? They're conditioned to do that. They can't do anything different. And there's something beautiful about that, because it means that you know that everyone is the victim of that conditioning that they have, and they can't really be any different. Compassion comes in very quickly. Okay. So, we have a few more questions. Dear Arjan, for one returner or seven returner, that's the stream entry, where the rebirth takes place, must it be in the human realm? What about non-returner? And where does the perfection to Arahant take place? When or where? Where did the perfection to Arahant? Okay, so let's start with this. So the once returner, they say that it says that they return once. And the question is, where is it that they return once? And according to the standard explanation, they return once to the sensual realm. And the sensual realm is very vast. It can be any kind of heavenly realm within the sensual realm. That is where they come back. So that is the once returner. The stream entry, which you call here the seven times returner, because that's the maximum number of returns you can have as a stream enterer, it can take place in anywhere also within the sensual realm. You don't know. There is one of the stream enterers called the Eka Biji. Biji is like a seed, the one seeder, the one that comes back once, and they are said to come back once to the human realm. So you come back once to the human realm, then you make an end of suffering from there. The seven times returner, it isn't clearly defined exactly where you get reborn, but presumably it is within the sensual realm seven times at the most. Because once you go to the Brahma realm, then you can never come back again if you are a stream enterer. Once you get reborn in the Brahma realm, you're on the way out of here. It is called the Jhana Anagami. Jhana Anagami is the non-returner. So once you have the stream enter and you get reborn Brahma Loka, you are a Jhana Anagami, can never come back again. So that means it has to be within the sensual realm. So this is the kind of usual way of understanding this. What about the non-returner? Non-returner must go straight to the Jhana realms. It can never come back to the sensual realm at all. Any of the sensual heavens, all of that is out, and you get reborn in the Brahma Loka, which is the Jhana realms. According to this is the standard Buddhist understanding of these things. Where the perfection to Arahant takes place, perfection to Arahant can take place. You mean for the non-returner, and for the non-returner, it then takes place in the Jhana realms. If you go into a Jhana realm, and you are already a stream enterer or non-returner, the moment you come out of the Jhana, bang, Arahant, and you're out of here, and that's you're finished, and that's kind of Arahantship. But apart from that, it's interesting that Arahant, you can become an Arahant in many different places. You can become an Arahant as a human being. You can be a Deva, and it seems like you can become an Arahant as a Deva as well. So Devas, you can maybe have Arahant Devas. So these states of perfection, remember the Buddha is teacher of gods and humans. So gods are also included. So you can kind of hang out in the Devaloka, and the Buddha comes and gives you nice teaching. One of the nice things about the Devaloka, which people often miss or underestimate rather, is that in the Devaloka, there probably are a lot of Aryas up there. Because where do the Aryas get reborn? Well, pure people get reborn in the Devaloka. So Aryas, yeah, there's going to be a lot of Aryas. Yeah, a lot of noble people up there. That's kind of nice, isn't it? You go up and you kind of hang out with all the noble ones, the stream enterers and all these kind of things. Much more likely to be there than in the human realm. Human realms, we are a bunch of scallywags compared to the Devas. It's more unlikely to find any kind of really special people here. Turn left. No, that's the wrong way. Eightfold path. Okay. That's good. Sometimes Eightfold Path is left, that's true. So yeah. Okay, so I hope you are happy with that. Next two. Venerable Ajahn, this morning your explanation of the Satta Bodhanga awakening factors at investigation of Dhamma, one abides within the fourth jhana, or one actually has to come out from the fourth jhana in order to investigate the Dhamma, Sāruddha times three. The investigation of the Dhamma is long before you get to the jhana states. Remember there's a sequence here. So you start off with the Sati Sambhojanga. This is the mindfulness. This is like the watching the breath or any kind of the Satipatthana practices. Yeah, or the reflection on the Dhamma and all of these kind of things. Then you have the investigation of Dhamma after that. So, and the investigation of Dhamma in this case is either it is just a reflection on the teaching, and because you reflect on the teaching, you get the energy and the rapture, all of that arising from that. Yeah. Or the reflection on the teaching can be like the Satipatthana Sutta, where you understand the defilements of the mind, and because you understand them, you abandon them. You need to understand them to be able to abandon them. And this is what is happening in Dhammavicaya. You start to understand what is going on. And then, based on that, then you go through this whole sequence until you reach Samadhi and the fourth jhana. So these things are opposite ends of the bhujangas, and you have to go through the whole sequence. Virya, energy, piti, joy and rapture, pasadi, tranquility, then samadhi. Yeah, it's a long way up. And then from samadhi, you go to the fourth jhana, which is upeka. And as you do this, the whole process is one of both samatha and vipassana, because for every stage that you move up the sequence, you feel both more calm and you have more clarity, more clear seeing. So this whole process, and often this process may not go all the way to the end. It's actually very rare that it goes all the way to the end. And every time you come out of that process, the meditation doesn't go any deeper, and then you reflect back, like we were talking about in the Anapanasati Sutta, you reflect back on that process, and that is often where you can have some more profound insight into what is going on. If you get to the fourth jhana, after you come out of the fourth jhana, its insight almost happens to you. It's almost like you have no choice. It just bang, and you gain these insights. You don't really have to steer your mind all that much, because you already have the right view. You already have the power of the samadhi, and the two together is like a match and the kind of fuel, bang, coming together, and then you get the explosion, which is like insight. This is like a simile for the insight. And this is one of those fascinating things. You know, the Noble Eightfold Path ends with the jhanas. The bhujangas end with upeka. Upeka means literally looking on. So when you get to this point, you are looking on. Yeah, you have the mind which is very even, and all you do is look. The very, very steady mind. And then as you look, this whole thing just opens up for you, and you understand what is going on. You've just been through a process, and that because you've just been through it, it is very clear in your memory, and you see how that process works. The abandoning of things, the giving up of things, so that you can enter the jhanas, and then you see impermanence. You see suffering. You see how this whole thing is non-self and gone. So this is how you do it. I know that in many kind of traditions, they teach that after jhana you have to kind of, you know, go into insight and all of this. But if you practice this in the right way, you don't actually have to do very much after a jhana state. You can just sit back and just reflect on what has happened, and then this happens almost automatically, and then the insight sort of just comes by itself pretty much. And this is kind of what you see in the suttas. If you want to have more insight before the jhanas, or more understanding, then you may have to direct the mind a little bit more, because until you have the jhanas, the mind is not as steady, so you need more direction to pinpoint it, perhaps. But after jhana, it's just these things just happen. You can't avoid it. You must have insight after jhana. Is that good? It's pretty good. It's very easy. Yeah, this is kind of the nice thing about it. Everything just happens. So. Excuse me. Okay. Next one. Venerable Ajahn, can you please explain the difference between Cheto Vimutti and Panya Vimutti? Is there a difference in the practice that leads to different types of liberation? Thank you, Saru times three. Cheto Vimutti means liberation of mind. Cheto is mind. Panya Vimutti, Panya means wisdom, so that's liberation by wisdom. And the difference is that it depends on the context in which they are used, but Cheto Vimutti can, for example, be a state of samadhi. If you come out of a jhana state or you come out of a Brahma Viharas are called Cheto Vimuttis. And they are Cheto Vimuttis because the mind is liberated from the hindrances, liberated from those negative states. That's why you are liberated. But it is a temporary liberation, right? Because samadhi is temporary, it's not a final liberation. So that is one of the meanings of Cheto Vimutti. Panya Vimutti means liberation through wisdom. And this means when you have seen reality fully, and of course then there is no return back again. It is a final liberation. But sometimes, very often, Panya Vimutti and Cheto Vimutti are used together. They are used kind of as a pair. So when you become an arahant, it is often said you have both Cheto Vimutti and Panya Vimutti when you become an arahant. And that is because both of these liberations come together. You are both liberated from the defilements, just in the same way as you are liberated through a jhana state, but you're also liberated through the insight or understanding so that those defilements can never come back again. It is both a liberation of mind in the sense that the mind feels free, but it's so you feel the freedom that comes from that liberation, but it's also an insight at the same time so that there is no returning back, if you see what I mean. And then those two things coming together, that means that you both feel good and there's no turning back at the same time. There is something also called the Upatubhaga Vimutti as well, and this means liberated in both ways, and that refers to the fact that you are not only do you have the Panya Vimutti, the full liberation of the arahant, but you also have the immaterial attainments as well. Upatubhaga Vimutti means that you have access to the very high states of liberation of samadhi that are beyond the four jhanas. That's what it means, the Upatubhaga Vimutti. So this is when you have you're an arahant, but you have extra samadhi on top of what is required for arahantship. Empty. Yay! That's good news, isn't it? Emptiness is always the best, according to Buddhism. Is there any more questions or anything anyone would like to add? Or is everyone exhausted? Yes, Barbara, okay. Do we have a microphone for her? At the back, at the very back there, the microphone, yeah. To aspire to be a Buddha, bypass the arahanthood, it is not realistic. I'm just being blunt, because there is no path to Buddhahood. There is no path, there is only one path in the suttas, and that path is the path to arahantship. So to become a Buddha is like a random thing. It just happens occasionally to occasional people, but there's no path to go there. The idea of a path to Buddhahood is a later development that came in the commentaries and came in Mahayana Buddhism. So it is not actually laid down by the Buddha. And because it isn't laid down by the Buddha, who has the authority to lay down the path to Buddhahood if the Buddha didn't do it? Nobody has that authority. Yeah? And there's some kind of anonymous person decided we need a path to Buddhahood, but actually there is no one with that authority. So it is not advisable to become a bodhisattva and to aim for Buddhahood. Arahantship is really the only way here. Yeah. Anyone else want to say anything?
Yes.
Venerable, yeah.
I'm still trying to follow up with your chanting.
Okay.
Yeah. The morning and evening chanting.
Yeah.
I went to Paikiri in San Francisco and also Amaravati in UK.
Sure.
They chant?
Absolutely, yes.
Morning and evening chanting, how come at the Bodhiyana? What make Ajahn Brahm different?
The reason they do it is because that was the practice at Wat Papong in Thailand. Uh-huh. So in Ajahn Chah's monastery, they always did this, yeah? So they just follow along. They're like the white sheep, bah, and they follow along and just do exactly the same thing. Yeah. We are the black sheep, yeah? So we are the black sheep. We think for ourselves. We don't just follow along blindly. Yeah. And what is interesting is that in the Thai forest tradition, the only place really where, I think, as far as I know, where it was common to do morning evening chanting was in Ajahn Chah's monastery. I think in the Dhammayut monasteries, they didn't do that. So if you go to the Dhammayut forest monasteries, which were there were more Dhammayut forest monasteries than Mahanikaya forest monasteries. If you go to that, they didn't actually do this. This was a speciality of Lumpur Cha, and it was not something that you found in the other monasteries. So there is no, you know, you don't have just because you are Ajahn Chah's disciple doesn't mean that you have to follow exactly the same way. So that's why we do these things slightly differently. And one of the reasons is because Ajahn Brahm is into solitude. He loves solitude, and he always says that the best meditation is to be had in solitude. So there's no need to kind of meet together and sit together in groups. You sit in your kuti. That's the best place to do meditation practice. Okay. Any more questions? Yes, please. Is there a microphone for him? Okay, from Venerable over here. Yeah. I think you turned it off. Yeah. No.
If one has jhana, does it guarantee that after their passing away, does that mean they are going to Brahma Loka or they can come back to Kama Loka if they have experience of jhana?
It's not enough to have experience of jhana. You have to have a steady experience. Yeah, so you have to have a regular experience where you have access to the jhana. So even if you have attained it once or twice or 10 times, it's not enough. You have to have that habit, ability to re-enter it at will, pretty much. So it says, that's what it says in the sutta. So once you are really experienced with the jhanas, that means that when you die, you can enter the jhana easily and you get reborn in those realms.
Okay, that explains. Because I was wondering when you mentioned that when the Sotapanna, when they die, according to Ajahn's previous comments, that they should have at least jhana experience before they can become a Sotapanna or something like that.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I was wondering, if that's the case, why don't every Sotapanna become Anagami?
Right. Yeah.
So, that explains. Thanks.
Yep. Good. Yeah. Okay, any more questions? Is everyone exhausted? No? Somewhat or not? Okay. Okay, so no more questions? Okay. Oh, one at the back there. Yeah, please. You had to. Who is Mara or what is Mara? I will repeat it for the recording. That's okay. Who is Mara or what is Mara? It's a very good question. because it is far from obvious from the suttas what the answer to that is. But generally speaking, the most common way that Mara is used in the suttas is used as a psychological principle. So Mara is whatever kind of scares you or makes it difficult, or it is a defilement that arises in the mind. This is called Mara. So you can say that, you know, if you meditate and you have something arising which blocks you in the meditation, you could say it's Mara that is disturbing you, yeah? And it means just a psychological thing happening. Got nothing to do with anything in the broader than that. But occasionally Mara is used in the suttas to describe a kind of deity which tries to control things, yeah? Mara is supposed to be having reborn in what is called the Paranimitta Vasavati, and that is the realm of beings that like to control the creations of others. These are kind of control freaks in charge. And Mara is the head control freak, yeah? So it's really especially bad. So this is, according to the suttas, Mara can then sometimes interfere in human, you know, in human things. I think that that is a very secondary thing, and that normally when we talk about Mara, what we actually mean is the psychological issues that arise, that block you from accessing meditation. And whether there is, there probably are deities there, and sometimes they may interfere, whether that really is important, or whether that matters or not, I think it's largely irrelevant, and it doesn't really have any much relevance as far as meditation and the spiritual path is concerned. Yeah. Mara was a woman. Male. Mara is always male. Yeah. Yeah. Mara. So you're saying you thought Mara was a woman? Yeah. Well, that's because very often that's how you talk about it. Yeah. Because if you're a monk, you think, okay, you better have to be careful with women. So you think of women as Mara. But for the nuns especially, men are Mara. Yeah. It's the exact opposite. But it's true that the deity called Mara is always has to be male, yeah, according to the suttas. Yeah, that's true. Control freaks. Yeah, that's what happens. So. Okay. Anything else?
Ajahn,
yes, please.
Ajahn, could you explain on the Gaudika Sutta? Because when I read it feels like to me like an arahant can commit suicide.
Yeah, that's a nice sutta, isn't it? I'm very impressed. You read the suttas. Yeah, wow, I guess that's wonderful. Yeah, okay. That's great.
I heard a talk from another venerable. So he told me that arahant can commit suicide.
Yeah.
So I searched and then I saw there is a sutta
of this. Ah, okay, that's how you found it. Okay, yeah. There is a few suttas like that. There's a Bakkali Sutta, Gaudika Sutta, and one more, three places at least, where it looks like an arahant may have committed suicide. And I think that Bhikkhu Bodhi, who is one of the main translators into English, he agrees with that reading, that it actually looks like an arahant committed suicide. So it seems like it could happen. And the Buddha, in one place, he says that, well, if you do commit suicide as an arahant, basically, you know, it's okay, because you finish your job anyway, there's nothing more to do. So if you really have some unbearable pain or problem, something that is kind of difficult, then it's not an issue. But if you're not an arahant, it's worse, because you have more work to be done. Yeah, so it's kind of too early to commit suicide. It would be problematic. Yeah. So it looks like it may be possible, and it's quite, and that is very interesting, because when you talk about ethics and what is what the five precepts are, for example, sometimes the question is, well, is suicide covered by the five precepts or not? Now, the arahant is supposed to be perfect as far as the precepts is concerned. So if they can commit suicide, then maybe suicide is not covered by the five precepts. That's interesting. And it may very well be the case, because when we talk about killing, what we mean by any of the precepts is that we are depriving someone else of something they want. If you steal from somebody, well, they presumably want to have what you're stealing, yeah? So you're taking from them something they want to have. If you kill someone, it's only if they want to live that you're actually taking something away from them that they don't want. So if you want to die, and you have a good reason for it, and you want to commit suicide, is it bad? It depends on what your motivation is, whether it's bad or not. Yeah. So from a Buddhist point of view, these things are actually quite deep and quite complicated. It's not obvious that suicide is always wrong. if in certain conditions it is wrong, in other conditions it may not be wrong here. Okay. Anything else? Please.
If I were an arahant, I wouldn't have thought, you know, to commit suicide.
Well, there are different kinds of arahants. Some don't commit suicide, some do. Yeah, so you're the one that doesn't commit suicide. So there you are. It's interesting because that's what the sutta seems to be saying. Yeah, this is actually in there, and that seems to be the message. So sometimes it kind of gives you new ways of looking at the Dhamma. That's what's interesting about it. Yeah. Okay, everyone. So again, please have a nice night, have a good rest, and then we'll see you back again tomorrow morning. And let's just pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha before we go.